The end of the tether. I, for a long time after the course of the steamer Sofala had been altered for the land, the low swampy coast had retained its appearance of a mere smudge of darkness beyond a belt of glitter. The sunray seemed to fall violently upon the calm sea, seemed to shatter themselves upon an adamantine surface into sparkling dust, into a dazzling vapor of light that blinded the eye and wearied the brain with its unsteady brightness. Captain Wally did not look at it. When his serang, approaching the roomy cane armchair which he filled capably, had informed him in a low voice that the course was to be altered, he had risen at once, and had remained on his feet, face forward, while the head of his ship swung through a quarter of a circle. He had not uttered a single word, not even the word to steady the helm. It was the serang, an elderly, alert, little Malay, with a very dark skin, who murmured the order to the helmsman. And then slowly Captain Wally sat down again in the armchair on the bridge, and fixed his eyes on the deck between his feet. He could not hope to see anything new upon this lane of the sea. He had been on these coasts for the last 3 years. From Low Cape to Melanton the distance was 50 miles, 6 hours steaming for the old ship with the tide, or 7 against. Then you steered straight for the land, and by 3 palms, would appear on the sky, tall and slim, and with their disheveled heads in a bunch, as if in confidential criticism of the dark mangroves. The Sofala would be headed towards the Sommer strip of the coast, which at a given moment, as the ship closed with it obliquely, would show several clean shining fractures the brimful estuary of a river. Then on through a brown liquid, 3 parts water and 1 part black earth, on and on between the low shores, 3 parts black earth and 1 part brackish water, the Sofala would plow her way upstream, as he had done once every month for these 7 years or more, long before he was aware of her existence, long before he had ever thought of having anything to do with her, and her invariable voyages. The old ship ought to have known the road better than her men, who had not been kept so long at it without a change, better than the faithful serang, whom he had brought over from his last ship to keep the captain's watch, better than he himself, who had been her captain for the last 3 years only. She could always be depended upon to make her courses. Her compasses were never out. She was no trouble at all to take about, as if her great age had given her knowledge, wisdom, and steadiness. She made her landfalls to a degree of the bearing, and almost to a minute of her allowed time. At any moment, as he sat on the bridge without looking up, or lay sleepless in his bed, simply by reckoning the days and the hours he could tell where he was the precise spot of the beat. He knew it well too, this monotonous huckster's round, up and down the straits. He knew its order and its sights and its people. Malacca to begin with, in the daylight, and out at dusk, to cross over with a rigid phosphorescent wake this highway of the Far East. Darkness and gleams on the water, clear stars on a black sky, perhaps the lights of a home steamer keeping her unswerving course in the middle, or maybe the elusive shadow of a native craft with her mat sails flitting by silently, and the low land on the other side in sight at daylight. At noon the 3 palms of the next place of call, up a sluggish river. The only white man residing there was a retired young sailor, with whom he had become friendly in the course of many voyages. 60 miles farther on there was another place of call, a deep bay with only a couple of houses on the beach. And so on, in and out, picking up coastwise cargo here and there, and finishing with 100 miles steady steaming through the maze of an archipelago of small islands up to a large native town at the end of the beat. There was a 3 days rest for the old ship, before he started her again in inverse order, seeing the same shores from another bearing, hearing the same voices in the same places, back again to the Sofala's port of Registry on the great highway to the east, where he would take up a berth nearly opposite the big stone pile of the harbor office till it was time to start again on the old round of 1,600 miles and 30 days. Not a very enterprising life, this, for Captain Welly, Henry Welly, otherwise Daredevil Harry Welly of the Condor, a famous clipper in her day. No. Not a very enterprising life for a man who had served famous firms, who had sailed famous ships, more than one or two of them his own, who had made famous passages, had been the pioneer of new routes and new trades, who had steered across the unsurveyed tracts of the South Seas, and had seen the sun rise on uncharted islands. 50 years at sea, and 40 out in the East, pretty thorough apprenticeship, he used to remark smilingly, had made him honorably known to a generation of ship owners, and merchants in all the ports from Bombay clear over to where the East merges into the West upon the coast of the two Americas. His fame remained writ, not very large but plain enough, on the Admiralty charts. Was there not somewhere between Australia and China a Welly Island and a Condor Reef? On that dangerous coral formation the celebrated clipper had hung stranded for 3 days, her captain and crew throwing her cargo overboard with one hand, and with the other, as it were, keeping off her a flotilla of savage war canoes. At that time neither the island nor the reef had any official existence. Later the officers of Her Majesty's steam vessel Fusilier, dispatched to make a survey of the route, recognized in the adoption of these two names the enterprise of the man, and the solidity of the ship. Besides, as anyone who cares may see, the General Directory, Vol. I. Page 410 begins the description of the Aladu, or Welly Passage with the words colon this advantageous route, first discovered in 1850 by Captain Welly in the ship Condor, and C, comma and ends by recommending it warmly to sailing vessels leaving the China ports for the south in the months from December to April inclusive. This was the clearest gain he had out of life. Nothing could rob him of this kind of fame. The piercing of the Isthmus of Suez, like the breaking of a dam, had let in upon the East a flood of new ships, new men, new methods of trade. It had changed the face of the Eastern seas, and the very spirit of their life, so that his early experiences meant nothing whatever to the new generation of seamen. In those bygone days he had handled many thousands of pounds of his employer's money, and of his own. He had attended faithfully, as by law a shipmaster is expected to do, to the conflicting interests of owners, charterers, and underwriters. He had never lost a ship, or consented to a shady transaction, and he had lasted well, outlasting in the end the conditions that had gone to the making of his name. He had buried his wife in the Gulf of Petulai, had married off his daughter to the man of her unlucky choice, and had lost more than an ample competence in the crash of the notorious Travancore and Deccan Banking Corporation, whose downfall had shaken the East like an earthquake. And he was 65 years old. 2. His age sat lightly enough on him, and of his ruin he was not ashamed. He had not been alone to believe in the stability of the banking corporation. Men whose judgment in matters of finance was as expert as his seamanship had commended the prudence of his investments, and had themselves lost much money in the great failure. The only difference between him and them was that he had lost his all, and yet not his all. There had remained to him from his lost fortune a very pretty little bark, fair made, which he had bought to occupy his leisure of a retired sailor o' play with, as he expressed it himself. He had formally declared himself tired of the sea the year preceding his daughter's marriage. But after the young couple had gone to settle in Melbourne he found out that he could not make himself happy on shore. He was too much of a merchant sea captain for mere yachting to satisfy him. He wanted the illusion of affairs, and his acquisition of the fair maid preserved the continuity of his life. He introduced her to his acquaintances in various ports as "why last command." When he grew too old to be trusted with a ship, he would lay her up, and go ashore to be buried, leaving directions in his will, to have the bark towed out, and scuttled decently in deep water on the day of the funeral. His daughter would not grudge him the satisfaction of knowing that no stranger would handle his last command after him, With the fortune he was able to leave her, the value of a 500-ton bark was neither here nor there. All this would be said with a jocular twinkle in his eye. The vigorous old man had too much vitality for the sentimentalism of regret, and a little wistfully withal, because he was at home in life, taking a genuine pleasure in its feelings and its possessions, in the dignity of his reputation and his wealth, in his love for his daughter, and in his satisfaction with the ship, the plaything of his lonely leisure. He had the cabin arranged in accordance with his simple ideal of comfort at sea. A big bookcase, he was a great reader, occupied one side of his stateroom. The portrait of his late wife, a flat bituminous oil painting representing the profile, and one long black ringlet of a young woman, faced his bedplace. Three chronometers ticked him to sleep and greeted him on waking with the tiny competition of their beats. He rose at 5 every day. The officer of the morning watch, drinking his early cup of coffee aft by the wheel, would hear through the wide orifice of the copper ventilators all the splashings, blowings, and splutterings of his captain's toilet. These noises would be followed by a sustained deep murmur of the Lord's Prayer recited in a loud earnest voice. 5 minutes afterwards the head and shoulders of Captain Wally emerged out of the companion hatchway. Invariably he paused for a while on the stairs, looking all round at the horizon, upwards at the trim of the sails, inhaling deep draughts of the fresh air. Only then he would step out on the poop, acknowledging the hand raised to the peak of the cap with a majestic and benign "Good morning to you." He walked the deck till 8 scrupulously. Sometimes, not above twice a year, he had to use a thick cudgel-like stick on account of a stiffness in the hip, a slight touch of rheumatism, he supposed. Otherwise he knew nothing of the ills of the flesh. At the ringing of the breakfast bell he went below to feed his canaries, wind up the chronometers, and take the head of the table. From there he had before his eyes the big carbon photographs of his daughter, her husband, and 2 fat-legged babies his grandchildren set in black frames into the maple wood bulkheads of the cuddy. After breakfast he dusted the glass over these portraits himself with a cloth, and brushed the oil painting of his wife with a plumate kept suspended from a small brass hook by the side of the heavy gold frame. Then with the door of his stateroom shut, he would sit down on the couch under the portrait, to read a chapter out of a thick pocket Bible or Bible. But on some days he only sat there for half an hour with his finger between the leaves, and the closed book resting on his knees. Perhaps he had remembered suddenly, how fond of boat sailing she used to be. As he had been a real shipmate and a true woman too. It was like an article of faith with him that there never had been, and never could be, a brighter, cheerier home anywhere afloat or ashore than his home under the poop deck of the Condor, with the big main cabin all white and gold, garlanded as if for a perpetual festival with an unfading wreath. As he had decorated the center of every panel with a cluster of home flowers, it took her a 12-month to go round the cuddy with this labor of love. To him it had remained a marvel of painting, the highest achievement of taste and skill, and as to old Swinburne, his mate, every time he came down to his meals he stood transfixed with admiration before the progress of the work. "You could almost smell these roses," he declared, sniffing the faint flavor of turpentine which at that time pervaded the saloon, and, as he confessed afterwards, made him somewhat less hardy than usual in tackling his food. But there was nothing of the sort to interfere with his enjoyment of her singing. "Mrs. Wally is a regular out-and-out nightingale, sir," he would pronounce with a judicial air after listening profoundly over the skylight to the very end of the piece. In fine weather, in the second dog watch, the 2 men could hear her trills and roulades going on to the accompaniment of the piano in the cabin. On the very day they got engaged he had written to London for the instrument, but they had been married for over a year before it reached them, coming out round the Cape. The big case made part of the first direct general cargo landed in Hong Kong Harbor, an event that to the men who walked the busy quays of today seemed as hazily remote as the dark ages of history. But Captain Wally could in a half hour of solitude live again all his life, with its romance, its idyll, and its sorrow. He had to close her eyes himself. She went away from under the ensign like a sailor's wife, a sailor herself at heart. He had read the service over her, out of her own prayer book, without a break in his voice. When he raised his eyes he could see old Swinburne facing him with his cap pressed to his breast, and his rugged, weather-beaten, impassive face streaming with drops of water like a lump of chipped red granite in a shower. It was all very well for that old sea dog to cry. He had to read on to the end. But after the splash he did not remember much of what happened for the next few days. An elderly sailor of the crew, deft at needlework, put to Jeter a morning frock for the child out of one of her black skirts. He was not likely to forget, but you cannot dam up life like a sluggish stream. It will break out and flow over a man's troubles. It will close upon a sorrow like the sea upon a dead body, no matter how much love has gone to the bottom. And the world is not bad. People had been very kind to him, especially Mrs. Gardner, the wife of the senior partner in Gardner, Pattison, and Company, the owners of the Condor. It was she who volunteered to look after the little one, and in due course took her to England, something of a journey in those days, even by the overland mail route, with her own girls to Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.